Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Shop Talk Show this week. We have two sponsors I want to tell you about really quick. Environments for Humans at environmentsforhumans.com. They do conferences for us web folks. There's a bunch of cool ones coming up very soon. We'll tell you about those later in the show. And Squarespace 6, really nice. I say 6 because it's their 6th iteration, but it's a really nice web app for building websites. So check that out. We'll tell you about that later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Hold on. I got it ducked, and I'm going to unduck. Hello, and welcome to episode 34 of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design, development, other stuff, too. We talk about we're a sound effects podcast, the web's premier sound effects podcast, and I'm Dave Rupert with Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody. And we have a huge guest this week, Jeremy Keith. Thanks for joining us, Jeremy.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. I have to come up with like a title kind of for everybody each show. I don't have to, but when I'm going to tweet it out to tell everybody what guest I is, I can't just be like, and we have Jeremy Keith on the show. I like to like pre-qualify it. So I just called you a longtime super genius. I hope that's okay.
That's good. And I'm going to take that actually, because I update my job title on a weekly basis, and longtime super genius sounds perfect.
Nice.
I might do it right now while we're talking. I'm going to update my job title to longtime super genius.
That's fantastic. Where does it? Do you do it like your Twitter profile or just
no, on the Clear Left website? If you go to clearleft.com/is, it's got everybody at Clear Left and their job titles, and I just change it to a different job title each week.
Oh, that's awesome. So Clear Left has that URL sentences thing going on. Yeah.
Yeah, the URL structure is kind of a cutesy little thing, but it works.
Yeah. That is cool. So is that what you know, you spend most of your time at these days? So I mean, we should just do like the couple minutes of introducing people to you. Or do you think of yourself, so you're like the technical director at Clear Left, is that where most of your time is these days?
Sort of. I think I sometimes do actual work, you know, bit of HTML and CSS here and there. Yeah. But got to be honest, spend half my time organizing stuff or preparing for, you know, conferences or things like that. So I like to think of myself as the research and development arm of Clear Left, which involves a lot of goofing around on the internet, looking sure. at cat pictures in the name of
join the club. It's just knowledge. The best.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
okay, that's great. But you do. I mean, let's think. HTML5 for web designers. The very first of the A Book Apart books is all you.
Yeah, that was me. And I had two other books before that. Which I, you know, after I finished writing my first book, I swore I'd never write another. So I don't know what happened.
I'm at that point right now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. Yeah. You know, the process of writing was not fun, but yeah, I wrote some JavaScript books before that. Well, JavaScript books kind of for beginners, because I'm not a JavaScript expert by any means. So
That's funny that you say that after finishing books about AJ.
Well, but those books are aimed at people who don't know anything about JavaScript and want to learn. So if you got an expert to write those books, I think it would actually be really hard, because an expert forgets what it was like not to know stuff. So writing it from a beginner's perspective, which was easy for me because I'm a beginner, you know, kind of makes sense.
That's cool. It's nice to hear, because I feel that same way too. Like, I write about the web because I'm, you know, in some ways so bad at the things I'm writing at that I can like understand not understanding it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like you can put yourself in the shoes of someone who's kind of maybe a bit put off by all the jargon and the hype around technologies, and just try and make it straightforward, which is generally what I do. Yeah. So what was that title for me again?
Long time super genius.
Yeah. Long time super genius.
Look at this. Okay. One of the number one users on HuffDuffer right now is Chris C. What is that about?
Excellent.
It's not me, but it's cool. That's another thing you do, right? Create your own podcast.
Yeah, well, it's a bit more meta than that. create the means by which one can create one's right. own podcasts, if you get what I mean. Yeah, so HuffDuffer is just a way of, instead of subscribing to an entire podcast and having your, you know, iTunes or a podcast app fill up with all these podcasts that maybe you only actually want to listen to an episode or two, you just put your own podcast together by cherry picking from episodes rather than the whole podcast. It was just a classic case of scratching my own itch because I wanted something like that and I couldn't find it. So I built it and I thought, well, if it's useful for me, maybe somebody out there else would find it useful. So, you know, turn it into a service and people do seem to find it useful. So it's very, gratifying when that happens.
Yeah, totally. It's great. It's like, it's like Instapaper for audio in a way. If we need to do that, would that be fair?
Yeah, no, I used to describe it as like delicious for audio because it's like you're bookmarking these links, but actually thinking about it, it's much more like, Instapaper for audio because it's like I'll listen to it later rather than read it later.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And it was one of the, I remember it always is like, oh yeah, it's that awesome web app that has the, complete a sentence thing to
the sign up form. Yeah, the sign up form. That was so, that I didn't think it was a big deal at, you know, when I did it, cause you know, I thought, well, I want to make it friendly and CSS. You can make everything look however you want because, yeah, you know, that's CSS. You can change the style of anything. So I thought, okay, I'll make it this nice friendly kind of form where it's kind of talking to you. My idea was it would be kind of like you were signing up, literally signing up, like, I hereby declare that I will, you know. But once it was launched, all these people were linking to it. And I remember Dan Cederholm linked to it. He described it as Mad Libs, right? It's like a Mad Libs form. Well, here's so... Mad Libs, I take it, is quite a popular game in the United States of America. I had never heard of it. I didn't know what Mad Libs was. I didn't know what moon language Dan was speaking when he's doing check out the Mad Libs form on HuffDuffer. I thought it was some sort of street speak that I wasn't hip to. You know, it's like, hey, Mad Libs on the sign up form.
Oh, what like a, Mad what a descriptor.
Exactly. Like- yeah. What up, homie? Yeah.
That's funny, but it, you know, took off. I remember the people going wild.
I still get like screenshots of the sign up form in like PowerPoints from UX people. I still to this day.
Well, this is the thing. There was actually a bit of a fad for a while of people starting to do this, and actually Luke Rabluski did a little bit of A/B testing with, you know, here's a form beforehand, here's a form afterwards, but you know. It has to be admitted, the kind of the reason why I was working was because it was novelty. I wouldn't like to see all forms on the web suddenly go Mad Libs. You know, I do not want to be signing up to my bank with a Mad Libs style form. There's a time and a place for that kind of playfulness, I think. But yeah, in some situations it's kind of nice, but it's definitely a novelty factor.
Yeah, good point. I also don't want to see that, but I quite like it on the sign up form. Oh, all right, maybe we should.
If you go to clearleft.com/is, my job title is now longtime super genius.
Oh, that's so awesome!
Oh, and there's a Twitter account called Jeremy's Job, and that should update sometime in the next 5 minutes with my new job title. So if you want to see all my job titles, you can just look back through the history of Jeremy's Job on Twitter.
Totally subscribe.
That's great. Following.
Sweet. Let's see. So we have a little bit of what Jeremy pre-show called lukewarm drama, maybe some actual hot drama too. I was going to say, I have one more note in my little, like, about Jeremy section of my little markdown file here that we're looking at, of a classic quote that I really like on Daniel Mall's site. And he said, I once asked Jeremy Keith, my favorite speaker, for some advice on presenting. I think about this often. He said, this is what he told me. The most important thing is authenticity. As soon as you can fake that, you've made it.
It's so hilarious. I may have said sincerity. I can't recall, but once you can fake that, you got it made. Yeah. Yeah, I'm a smart arse, basically.
Okay, so the lukewarm drama I have, which we're going to gloss over because actually our first Q&A question is actually about this, was there is a post on Bruce Lawson's site. He's calling like the Scooby-Doo element. That's kind of funny. You have to read
the
article.
The Scooby-Doo algorithm.
Algorithm. Right, it's like everything that isn't a sidebar or a navigation or an aside or whatever. And it figures out that its main content, the drama being like, why? If HTML5, when they were deciding all these elements, aside, navigation, whatever, theoretically, and I think there's some truth to this, correct me if I'm wrong, but they looked at a ton of websites and found class names that like divs were using, essentially. And
sorry, my dog is freaking out.
I'm just going to say that wasn't me. That wasn't
me. It was just about and they looked at people would go div ID equals nav or div class equals nav ton.
Right? Well, actually, the timeline, the chronology is a little bit different. They actually came up with the names first. Then Hixie at this point had moved to Google. He was at Opera previously and had access to all this information. So he did run those tests and looked at what were the most common class names and IDs and saw that they matched pretty well. But it wasn't cause and effect. It wasn't that the research was done and then that's where the names came from. It was more the names were invented and then it was like, oh, look, they matched up pretty much like we thought.
That's interesting, though. But it's not, I mean, if we were to sit down, if these didn't exist and we sat down together today, we'd probably come up with a similar list because they're actually fairly obvious, right?
Yeah, you'd guess what they'd be.
Yep. But why, the one that we probably more sites use than any other is something like main or main content. So why didn't that make the list?
So the thing to remember about all these new elements, header, footer, section, article, aside, nav, they are not replacing IDs. They're much more like classes. So yes, you can have a page where you've got the header of the page and you've got the footer of the page. Mm-hmm. But if that's all they did, that's pretty wasteful. That really isn't much better than just, div ID equals header, div ID equals footer. The power comes from the fact that within a page you can have, say, a section. And that section can have a header. And that section can have a footer. It can be used multiple times. And that's how you could basically take any section content, as it's called, section, article, aside, nav, and treat it like a mini document within the document. And each one should have its own header, maybe its own footer. So the idea with those new elements was not about marking up just the document sort of one level in, but that these elements could be used all the way down and that the outline algorithm could make sense of them like that. So here's the big difference with this idea of a content or main content element is that people are only thinking about that for the document. So I want a main content element or content element for my document. And that's not the way that header or footer or any of those other things work. They can work for the document, but they're much more powerful when they're used multiple times, nested inside the section content. Now, what you can use on a document basis is ARIA role values, landmark roles. So you can say role equals banner, and you are saying this is like the header, the masthead for the document, right? That doesn't go all the way down. They are much more like IDs, but they're more powerful than IDs because they're a shared vocabulary. You don't make up your own role values with every new website. Mm-hmm. There's a list of these role values on the W3C site. So the value comes from browsers and assistive technology can know when I see that role value, it means this is the banner, the masthead for the site, right? So there is an ARIA role for main content. It's just role equals main.
Right.
So it already exists. Now, then you get into the whole question of, well, I'd rather it be an element. And I never quite understand why people always want to mint new elements and are unhappy with just taking an attribute, even an attribute that can only have a limited number of values that can only be used once per document. But basically, we already have the main content device with role equals main. You can slap it on a div, you can slap it on any element, and you're saying this is the main content of the page. So Bruce does a good job of going through the pros and cons of that. His point is about that the Scooby-Doo algorithm, as he refers to it, seems to be inefficient. in that the way that browsers figure out what is the main content of the page is by deducing it from saying everything that isn't the header of the page, the footer of the
page. This comes up sometimes. Like Instapaper probably has to do something like this, literally with JavaScript, to try to kind of figure out what the main content area is.
Yeah, exactly. So how do I know what's supplementary content? How do I know what's main content? Like I say, role equals main does solve that problem. So I don't see the need for an element like content or main content if all it does is reproduces role equals main. Partly because you would have an element that could be used once and only once in a document.
Right. That's the crux of this, isn't it? Like, right. I was trying to be convinced by what you're saying. I'm like, yeah, but there's nav and stuff. But those are all, like you said, header, footer, nav, all these things can be used multiple times in the page. They're just kind of generic descriptors. But main content really should only be used once, you know?
In HTML, there's currently one element that is used once per document, and that's
body,
title.
HTML? Title.
Nope. Title. HTML can be used zero or one times because you don't have to include it. Title is mandatory. Title is the one element that must be included once and only once in an HTML document. You could actually leave off HTML or body or head, and the browser is going to be fine. It's going to figure its way around. I mean, I wouldn't recommend it, but you can. Technically, it's not mandatory. Title is the only element that may be used once and only once. And it sounds like this content or main content element would be a similar proposition, that you would use it once and only once. Maybe zero or once, right, that it wouldn't be mandatory. But I do think maybe there is a case for having a content or main content element per sectioning content. So if I've got an article and I've got a section, that within that I can say, here's the header, here's the footer, and here's the main content.
Mm. And then just in case you need to position it or something, or
again, I'm thinking more for things like readability, Instapaper, assistive technology. Because we said role equals main is per document. That's saying this is the main content of the document. But a document could contain many subsections, many articles, many asides. And it would be kind of nice to be able to explicitly say, this is the main content of this section. This is the main content of this aside. Now, browsers can figure that out using the Scooby-Doo algorithm, but I could see the case for allowing the author to explicitly say, this is the main content, but I'm not convinced. Just on a document level, but for any sectioning content.
Make it happen. Shop Talk Show's official stance.
Make it happen.
Is that the content element would be a good idea to be used like header and footer within sections or articles.
Yeah, and I would say if that were to happen, 80% of the time people would be using it just for the document level stuff, but I do think it should at least have the power to be used within any section content. That's my take on it.
Oh, that was good. We may play an audio question then be like, just reverse the podcast a minute. Anyway.
Oh, did I just answer somebody's question?
Oh, no, it was really nailed. That was a fantastic look at this. I have a couple links I want to put out, and then we'll officially jump into the Q&A portion of the podcast. Okay. One of the things
I could mention the really hot drama, which is related to what we were just
talking about. Oh, please do. Let's do that
first. Yeah, hold on. This deserves a sound effect. I want this here.
Okay, I'm a little late catching up to this because I've been really busy, and so my HTML mailing list emails have been piling up, so I'm only getting this sort of second hand. But I mentioned ARIA roles and the whole issue of ARIA in HTML. One of the chairs of the HTML working group, and I don't mean the WatWG, I mean the W3C, in an attempt to try and push a resolution on an issue that's been outstanding for maybe 2 years, it's related to the really long-running long desk stuff, said, look, you know, either you've got to sort this out, come up with an alternative proposal, or we'll just take ARIA out of the spec altogether. Mm.
Really? Which,
yeah, a bluff, I think it'd be fair to say. But it's kind of out of order, I think. I need to hear all sides. But what's interesting is that clearly this blew up. Like I said, I haven't been checking emails. So I'll get to read a lot of hot drama, I'm sure, when I was
unaware of this hot drama. And it comes fresh off the heels of last week. There was we were just talking about how there's some new roles and some people working at the W3C whose kind of job it is to mitigate drama the idea that there's going to be less of it.
Yeah, yeah. But I usually get all my hot drama from CSS Squirrel. Right, I just look, what's CSS girl talking about this week? That's the hot drama. And this week it's this ARIA role stuff. So the drama got so hot that Tim Berners-Lee himself had to come in and say, "Children, children, work it out." So that's a drama, right?
It is. That's some capital. That's capital hashtag hot drama, not lowercase.
Yeah. Yeah, that's soap opera stuff.
That's interesting. I feel Aria. I have a tangled love affair with it. I won't want to use it, but it's not clear. It's somewhat complicated, but then it's like people are like it's easy, but then it's not, you know. And then,
well, I mean, it's not. It was never intended as a permanent solution. I mean, hopefully there will be a day when Aria is not needed anymore because the language natively and browsers and screen readers will natively be able to do all the stuff that Aria is currently doing. So it is kind of a stopgap solution. But it's, you know, it works and it's implemented. It's implemented really widely in browsers and screen readers. So I'm certainly not about to drop it anytime soon.
I feel terrible. I really need to get on it.
It's good. I mean, if you want to keep track of where exactly and which specific bits are implemented, then Steve Faulkner is the guy to follow. Steve Faulkner and Jez Lemon, they're both really expert in this stuff. And they're doing a lot of good work, and they do a lot of good work of documenting it for the rest of us, right? Because it isn't always easy to figure out how you're supposed to use an Aria role or any of this stuff. So those guys are great.
Yeah, okay, good. We'll put that stuff in the show notes for you folks. Listen in radio style, shoptalkshow.com for that stuff. Okay, cool. Just three quick links. We're going to get through this so we can get as much of your guys' questions in as possible. Last week we had Alex King on, WordPress dude from Crowd Favorite, and he was like, "Oh, I should have advertised some open positions we have. Can I have an advertising spot?" I'm like, "Alex, thanks for being on the show. We'll mention those for you for him for sure. They're hiring at Crowd Favorite, which is like a WordPress development shop. So go to crowdfavorite.com/jobs. And he said, "We're hiring one specifically for front end." So I think a lot of you Shop Talk Show listeners are front end peeps. So they're specifically hiring at CrowdFront, a front end position. So just go check out that URL and see if WordPress is your game. It seems like a pretty sweet place to work in Denver, Colorado. So thanks, Alex, for being on the show again, and I hope we get him a hire out of this. That would be sweet. One of our listeners, Joe Savage, wrote in about, like, he's putting together this new kind of learning resource thing, and he's like, "You should check it out, and if you like it, share it on the show." And it really is pretty cool. It's called dev-hq.net, and it's just a whole series of like free screencasts about learning stuff, but in kind of like order. Like, I'm always kind of jealous of that because I do all these screencasts and CSS tricks, but if you just go look at the archive of them, they're a bit random and they're just like about whatever I happen to be interested at the moment. There's no like sequential learning order to them. So Joe Savage put together this. It's just in his style kind of thing. And there's HTML and C++, even in Ruby, and a bunch of other technologies that we don't normally cover here, but they're kind of in order. So good work on that, Joe. So if you're looking for a resource to point somebody towards that's like how to learn about HTML and CSS, he has these kind of these videos in order, which is pretty neat. And then Dave, well, you put one in here about another podcast.
I saw on Eric Meyer's site that he's teaming up with Jen Simons from The Web Ahead to do a podcast called, I think it's called The Web Behind. And what it is it's a history of the web podcast. And I know we've talked about it in shows in the past, you know. We talked about how cool it would be to kind of archive and document the history of web standards, of CSS, of HTML and elements and accessibility and stuff. So this is kind of doing that. So I think it should be pretty cool. Obviously, Eric has been involved in CSS for quite a while. So
I bet they'll have Jeremy on. Have you heard about
actually? I'm so excited about what they're doing. I'm really, and I have been talking to Eric. Last time I saw him at Event Apart. So I'm going to be begging to get on that show, but I'm really looking forward to hearing voices from the past on that podcast. I think it's a really good idea.
No, I just there's so many people who, you know, like know little stories through the history. I mean, it's just a short, you know, 20, 30 year history here that this has been around, but like, or I guess 20 years, but like, you know, we got to get it now before like people retire and move to like Jamaica. So
what I find fascinating with, you know, the history of, you know, where this stuff came from and the web standards and all the stuff is that stuff does go in cycles, and some new technology will come along and we as web developers be confronted with some seemingly new problem. But if you've been around long enough, you'll kind of go, wait a minute. I remember being confronted with a really similar problem back in the day for a completely different reason. Like, to give you an example, when Ajax was the buzzword and everyone was doing Ajax, Ajax, like, oh no, there's all these issues with Ajax because if you hit the back button, it doesn't matter how many times you've loaded stuff in with Ajax, you're going to go back to a previous document, or you can't bookmark the changed state of a page. Right? This is back in 2005, 2006. And when people were saying this, I was thinking, wait a minute, I remember this. This was Frames. We had these exact same problems with Frames, right? And with Flash as well. And now with things like, you know, responsive images, how are we going to sort that out? Like, wait a minute. I remember back in the 90s when we didn't have much bandwidth and we were trying to figure out how to send, you know, images, you know, quickly get something to the user and then swap it out with something more high fidelity. We had things like low source. It's all the same stuff coming back. It's all cycles, right?
Yeah, that's funny. Just how it all happens over again.
Yeah. All of this has happened before. All of this will happen again.
Hopefully some of the content that they get out of the show. Like, I think the last time we mentioned it on the show, we talked about, like, wouldn't it be cool if there was a, like, a documentary movie about it? And maybe, like, the foundations that they lay in this podcast and gathering all this information will be the kind of source material for something like that in the future, whether they do it or somebody else is able to take some of the stuff they dig up and turn it into that. That would be pretty sweet. It reminds me of the, like, the stuff with the picture element and stuff about how, you know, like, let's get it to work at all. And like you were just mentioning the Ajax and the you know, Frames and stuff. And it's like, okay, so we invented Ajax, or somebody did, or whatever. And now the browser button doesn't work. So then they fix it. They put in push state to, like, make it better. You know, now the back button does work. So, like, we first let's get it to work at all, and then we'll improve and iterate it beyond that. That's just what went through my mind.
Great job. Can I throw in a link as well? Seeing as you guys, the first one was for a job opening. I've got a job opening to pimp.
Yes, do it.
Yeah, please.
Clear Left is hiring, and you can see that by going to clearleft.com/is/hiring. It's for an interface designer, so basically visual designer. It has the word senior in front of it, but that doesn't mean we're just looking for old people. We'll take people of every age.
As long as you're good, right?
Yeah, and it would mean moving to Brighton, but that's not a downside. That's definitely a positive. But I just thought I'd throw that out there.
It's a good tech scene there, is it not?
Brighton is pretty awesome, yeah. There's a lot of geeks. There's a lot of meetups, a lot of really smart people living in Brighton. You know, Sebley Delisle, Remy Sharp, all of these people, you know, easily, you know, just bump into them down the cafe or in the pub. It's pretty great.
That is great. So Clear Left is hiring too. We'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Let's kick off the question and answer portion of the Shop Talk Show. This one we might gloss over, but let's play it anyway, just in case there's something I missed.
Here we go.
Hey, guys. My question is, why doesn't HTML5 have a main element or a content element? Something to wrap everything that is not the header or footer. It seems like, for styling purposes, I cannot get by without somehow wrapping everything else in a div or section. And 95% of the sites that I, you know, code inspect are all using a div with an ID of main or a class of main, which just makes me wonder, like, isn't that missing from HTML5? Isn't there a need for this element? Thanks a lot. Bye.
So that it's just what I thought. I mean, we talked about this at length, so I don't think we need to dwell on it. But just
we covered it. But he does bring up the styling issue. Like, It sounds like part of the reason why he wants to have this main element is so that you can target it with CSS, and you know, using an ID seems redundant. But I would say that the role equals main solution solves that as well. You just use an attribute selector. And in fact, I use roles in my CSS quite a bit, as you know, to target elements. So I might want to style all headers in a document a certain way and all footers in a document a certain way. And remember, there could be multiple headers and multiple footers because there's multiple sections, multiple articles. But I want to style the header of the page differently, and I want to style the footer of the page differently. Well, the header of the page, I'm going to slap a role equals banner on that. And the footer of the page, I've probably got a role equals content info on that. Maybe role equals supplementary is another one. And so because they are more or less unique, or you can certainly, they tend to work well when they're once per document, I can use them like I would use IDs, right? I target them in my CSS just using an attribute selector. You don't get into the specificity wars that you get into with IDs. And they're better than IDs because, like I said, they're an agreed-upon vocabulary. So what he's looking for already exists. It's just not an element.
Okay. Yeah, good point. I've been seeing that. I've seen, you know, in the redesign of the Shop Talk show, you used that a bit, Dave, didn't you?
I think so. Yeah, I've been into role equals main and role equals navigation. I like it. I'm down.
Yeah, so. I like it too.
It's fun.
Let's see. This one's by Zach Harkley. I don't think he said his name in the thing. I don't think we said it either. So thanks for the question, Zach. Andrew
Peel. Thank you, Zach, for your question.
Yes, indeed. This next one's by Andrew Peel. He says, this is kind of, I have to make sure I say this right so it feels like a question. The increasing semantic nature of HTML benefits browsers, search engines, and screen readers. It's kind of the stuff we were talking about, using the right elements and the role. But he says, but not developers, ? An example of this would be Pamela Fox's tweet about attributes. And I will link this tweet, but I'll read the tweet out loud, too, for the radio folks. Pamela says, oh, shoot, why isn't that loading? Oh, no, it's saying it doesn't exist all of a sudden. That's too bad. But she was saying, I read the tweet earlier.
I got it here. It's random thought. It would be neat if you could add a href equals to any HTML DOM node to make it linkable instead of having to add a whole anchor node.
Ah, now that's interesting because that did exist in XHTML2, which of course never existed in the real world, but that was in the works. You know, going way back to when work on HTML had stopped and W3C were putting their eggs into the XML basket, and the next iteration was going to be XHTML2, which you had to send as XML, which is a crazy idea. But anyway, one of the ideas of that was, yeah, any element could take an href. And that idea was, I believe, I might be getting this wrong, but I think that was floated for HTML5 as well. It's like, okay, that's actually not a bad idea. Let's try and do it. But then reality gets in the way, and it turns out that's really, really hard for the implementers to implement. And you'd have to have all kinds of rules to figure out, well, wait a minute, what if you've got an href on an element, and then inside that element, you have another element, and that has an href. Where do you send the user? That's a mess, right?
Because it's kind of the opposite of, like, event propagation to, like I don't know, like, which one happens first.
Right. It's going to be a mess. So I actually think that the compromise, you know, is pretty good that in HTML5, as opposed to every other version of HTML before, you can wrap an A element around whatever you want. The block level element, any kind of element, you can wrap it in an A and your code is valid. I mean, you could do that before. You could do that with HTML4 or with HTML3.2.
Which was invalid.
Exactly. It would still work because people were doing it. That's the thing.
Right.
Even though it was never allowed, people were doing it because it's so damn useful. Right. And browsers have to implement what people are using in their markup. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's related to the semantics question, because it's not like HTML5 is only satisfying the needs of those who want to have extra semantics in HTML. In fact, I would say the semantics part of HTML is a pretty small portion, right? A handful of new elements. We've got this new kind of content, section content. But the vast majority of stuff in HTML is there for developers, as in, you know, web development of applications.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually where the priority is.
Yeah. I can understand. I think I feel where Andrew's coming from. He's just thinking of HTML5 as these, you know, a couple new elements, and there's something that's missing that he wishes were there. But if you look at HTML5 as a whole, Andrew, there's a very lot of new stuff for developers there.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I don't think enough time has been spent on the semantic side of stuff. I think the efforts are very, very much in the development side. You know, the app stuff, the web app stuff. Yeah, powerful stuff for JavaScript APIs, enhancing forms. That's all great, but I wish there were actually a bit more balance. But I take the point that the most immediately useful stuff to developers is not the extra semantic richness that comes with section and header and footer. That's clearly maybe a bit more clearly beneficial for the end user because it's more useful for browsers, search engines, assistive technology. But then again, I think we should be prioritizing the end user above ourselves.
Yeah, good point. That was kind of a just slightly lukewarm drama there almost.
Well, it all relates to the design principles of HTML, right? And there's this my favorite of all the design principles is called the priority of constituencies, which says what to do in case of conflict. Okay, you've got a solution to a problem, solution A and solution B. How do you decide which solution to choose? The priority of constituency states, if I remember it rightly, in case of conflict, consider users over authors, over implementers, over theoretical purity. I think I've got that right, something like that. But basically, users are more important than us, developers, authors, but we're more important than the browser makers, the implementers, but they're more important than theoretical purity. And it seems like a really obvious design principle, right? So it's like, well, duh, what other way would you do it? But again, we were talking about XHTML2, and the design principles of XHTML2 were exactly the opposite, because theoretical purity was absolutely the priority. And the users came pretty far down the stack when you consider that in XHTML2, the idea was you had to serve your documents as XML. And so if there was a single error in the document, the user would get nothing. They would get an error and the document wouldn't render. So that's, even though the priority of constituency seems really obvious, it's actually good to have it written down and that everyone agrees on it.
Cool. I think if we could make one small revision, it should be podcasters first, then users.
Podcasters over users over authors. Yeah, that seems fair. Maybe it should be like cats, right? Cats over users. Because that would fit, you know, we're talking about paving the cow paths, right? It's another one of the buzzwordy design principles.
The cat paths.
What's the internet all about? Cats. Clearly, that's the most common use of the internet.
We probably need a cat element in that regard.
Maybe cats over porn, over authors, over...
I don't know. It's going to be a lot of upset people.
We have an audio element, so why not? But should we go on to the next question here?
I really got to do a sponsor because we have two to get through, and it's going on a while here. But thanks for hanging on, folks. Squarespace we have back for a sponsorship, and they're really cool. We've talked about them in the past in the context of like. Sometimes it's just really nice to make a website really quickly that is guaranteed to be super nice that you can just manage it online. And I, in the context of my life as Chris Coyer, the human being, I am way happier setting up somebody that comes to me like as a friend. I have this like a photographer friend that's a great photographer but wants me to build a website for him. Like the rest of you, my time is just short these days and I really want to help him because he's a really dear friend of mine. But I can't like build something from scratch from him because I just have to say no to that. Otherwise, like I wouldn't have a viable career if I said yes to all that type of stuff. But now I can just be like, check it out. I'm going to set you up on Squarespace and I'll walk you through the whole thing. We're going to pick a template for you that it's awesome, that looks amazing, that's like tailor-made to show off your beautiful
photos and that you can manage. You can easily add new photos. It has like cool drag and drop stuff. It will be really obvious and simple on how to use this. And I can even train you, but you probably won't even need any training because their app is really nice and intuitive, and set him up on something like that. So I can say yes when a guy comes to me that needs a website like that. Instead of like, no, sorry, I'm too busy, and being a crappy friend, I can now go to Squarespace. But Squarespace isn't just for that either. You know, it's for, I don't know, you can build pretty powerful, you know, build a blog on there. There's no reason that a professional person couldn't use it as well. So I was just explaining how it kind of fits into my life, but I'm very glad that they're a sponsor of us. And I tell to you advanced people who build web interfaces for a living, it's kind of worth signing up for a free plan just so you can like explore their interface, because it's pretty new school, and you can learn as a web developer just by like using their interface. You're like, dang, I wish I could build interfaces that nice. that's Squarespace. Let's do another question. We have one from Patrick Cox.
Okay, here we go. It's from Patrick Cox.
Hey guys, love the show.
Oh wait, am I on the right one? I'm gonna back it up. That is not
just
Patrick
a second.
Cox.
I should say, yeah, you do get a bit of a discount on Squarespace by using code ShopTalk9. It used to be ShopTalk8, but now it's 9 because it's a new month or whatever. So you get 10% off your any purchase there. Yeah, what do you got to back up?
I skipped ahead. Here we go.
Hey Chris, Dave, and Jeremy, I've got a quick question on mobile first design. My biggest concern about mobile-first design is that it seems like it's watering down the visual design into like simple table-like layouts and full displays. Although I like the mobile-first idea, it seems like it kills off the visual creativity in larger displays, because designers tend to focus on the mobile side and like all the content, and then just stretch these designs to fit the larger screens using like grid layouts and stuff. I feel like the display-first adaptive approach to responsive design lets you focus on the visual creativity and the experimentation because you have a bigger canvas to draw from. Do you think that these mobile-first constraints hinder or help creativity, or am I just crazy? Thanks.
Okay, it's a good question. Is mobile-first killing web design? Jeremy?
Patrick, you're crazy. Mobile-first is a great way to design. But I take the point, and this kind of comes down to language, because what we need is a way to distinguish, when we talk about design, we need a way to distinguish between the layout, okay? So this is going to be things like the grid system, how stuff is laid out. And when people talk about design a lot of time, that's what they're saying, oh, it's a beautiful design, they're saying it's a beautiful layout. We need to distinguish between that part of the design and the look and feel. Andy Clark is a nice word. He calls it the atmosphere of the site, right? So when you're doing mobile first, sure enough, you don't get to do layout. You don't get to design a beautiful grid system and position things in a beautiful way with beautiful proportions, because you're starting with a really, really narrow constraint. But you can start designing the look and feel. I mean, I guess in advertising agencies, this would be what the brand identity or whatever terms they use, but you know, that color, typography, look and feel, atmosphere. So I mean, a tool that I found really, really useful is Samantha Warren's Style Tiles, right? So where you're not designing a layout, but you are designing the feel, the atmosphere of the site. A great tool for communicating with clients. And I would say, once you get used to this, then when you've got a good brand identity, good feel, good colors, typography, and you've done the mobile first thing where you've really had to think about what's the most important content and really, really prioritize that then when you move to the larger view, when you think, okay, now I've got to think about how do I design for larger screens, It's this great feeling. It's like this, I've been given this huge canvas to work with. It's a gift, right? Whereas before, if you were thinking, I start with my canvas, then I've got to lay things out, and then, oh no, how am I going to shrink this down for smaller screens? That is really, really hard, I think. It's just, and it's no fun. Whereas if you start with a smaller screen and you get a consistent look and feel that's going to work at all sizes, but then you're given this larger canvas and now you get to position things and lay things out, have the beautiful proportions between elements, it's really liberating. It's like, this is so good, because you've already got a solid foundation of the look and feel of the atmosphere of the brand identity, and now it's a matter of making it work for that particular kind of device, a laptop, a desktop, tablet, whatever it might be. So I think starting mobile first is not only really, really good for the content, and it's clearly good for that reason because it forces you to prioritize. I actually think it's really, really good for the design process because it stops you relying on layout and positioning as your only crutch, right? I mean, if your design falls apart when it isn't laid out like you want, right? If it's just the layout that makes it beautiful, then maybe there needs to be something more underneath it, right? Going deeper down into the color, typography, the, you know, inherent proportions. So I know it's kind of tough at first, but once you get used to it, it is actually very liberating.
So perhaps what's in order, Patrick, is it like just a shift in your thinking a little bit to hopefully you can for lack of a better word, trick yourself into feeling that liberation instead of feeling hindered.
I think the thing is key of making a conscious separation between layout and kind of everything else, I guess. Right? That layout, essentially what you're doing is you're taking the principle of progressive enhancement and applying it to design because the layout is literally an enhancement. It's not your design. Your design is not the layout of stuff, right? And so if you've got this really solid core of a design language, then it's going to work at all different sizes. It's probably going to work on different media. You could probably take that and get a really good print campaign out of it, maybe TV campaign, because you've really gotten down to the nuts and bolts of it rather than just concentrating on the layout.
That's some deep stuff, guys. I need to learn this.
It reminds me of this whole thing about rewiring our brains. We kind of do need to do this for the mobile first responsive design. It does require a shift in our thinking, and this is for everyone, right? We're all going through this. But it totally reminds me of the whole web standards movement when we all used tables for layout and everything was mashed together. HTML was presentation and structure. And then CSS comes along. We've got the separation of concerns. And then the CSS Zen Garden came along and showed us, look, this is the same document, but by just changing the CSS, it's going to look completely different. And everyone went, aha. And in that moment that everyone went, aha, it was their brains being rewired to understand the new way of thinking about how you do stuff on a screen, how you approach the web. And it's kind of the same with the mobile first. It's just needing to have that aha moment.
I would also add, we live in a world where there's more mobile phones sold than PCs. So, like, more smartphones than like computers. So just consider that as you walk through your life. So our kind of big framed sites that are super glorious are probably going to lose their luster as things go on. That's my sort of stance on it.
Yeah. I have already started to think of the small screen view as the default. Like that's the default and the large screen view is the exception. And it wasn't that long ago I was thinking of the large screen view as the default and the small screen view as the exception that we had to we have to figure out how to make it work on small screens. My thinking has completely changed. And I have to remember that when I'm talking to people, clients or other developers, that when they talk about, you know, a website and how a website looks, their default image is of a desktop screen. Whereas when you say website to me, I imagine essentially the small screen view, the content effectively stripped down and, you know, straight to the content. On any screen, my priorities are completely switched around from what I consider the norm and the exception are now definitely small screens the norm and large screens the exception.
Fancy. It's being able to shift your mind like that is a skill in itself, and it's not always easy. You know the expression "who moved my cheese" that a lot of people use. I literally bought that book and I'm reading it. And for the most part, I find it kind of cheesy and like not the best written thing in the world. But the overall point of it is pretty interesting. In that, if your life gets stale or the you know, if you're not being effective anymore in what you're doing, that sometimes that shift into new thinking is difficult, but is almost always worth doing. So
yeah, it's always good to get out of habits of thinking. as humans, we like habits. We like to be in a comfort zone. We don't generally like to change how we think about stuff. But certainly on the web, sort of needs to happen quite often.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Let's do I have another sponsor here. Our longtime, lovely, lovely sponsor, Environments for Humans. So I've just learned how to spell the word environment from them. Thank you, guys. Environments is how I say it now to trick myself into spelling it correctly. Environmentsforhumans.com do conferences for us web folk. We've been mentioning the Honolulu stuff, the CSF. Yeah, the CSS DevConf and the In Control stuff are coming up in early December. We should say that the CSS DevConf is the speakers are now out for that, so you can go to CSS DevConf and read it. But okay, but I have to also mention that that's the one we've been pushing, and we're going to mention in the GIM. But more recently, or more coming up sooner, is Environment. They do these online ones, right, where you don't have to travel. You can just tune in on your browser and watch these conferences live. They're doing three in a row, September 25th. 26th and 27th, the first one being the Accessibility Summit. And these all have URLs, but I think it'll be easier for you if you're interested just to go to environmentsforhumans.com. They're all linked there. There's the Accessibility Summit the first day, the 25th, the UX Web Summit the second day, the 26th, and the Content Strategy Summit, September 27th. They all have great speakers, coupons, just lots of good ones. And you don't have to travel, you know, like if you live somewhere or it's just impractical for you to get on a flight and leave your family or whatever you have going on, these online ones are a good alternative to that. So we thought we'd mention those as well, but we really do want you to come to Hawaii to In Control. But all right.
Are you guys both going to Hawaii?
Totally.
Oh, I hate you.
It's not too late, Jeremy.
Oh, man, that's going to be so fun.
Yeah. I've never been there. I'm really excited about it. And I really already have coconut bras.
Well, bring me back a shirt.
Okay.
Hawaiian shirt.
Write that down. Bring Jeremy a shirt. Okay. Here's one just for Jeremy Keith from Ben Keeney. What is your take on the issue of HTML5 versus native apps for mobile? Do you foresee a future when HTML5 web-based apps become as efficient as native apps and ultimately dominate the space?
Well, look, first of all, this isn't an either-or situation. If you're, you know, any way reasonable-sized company, you're gonna have a presence everywhere, right? And if that's on the web, if that's going to be native for this platform, that platform, whatever. But I guess the question here is about the specific technologies you use to build an app for a phone, right? Or maybe not a phone. So it's a question about web app technology versus...
That it has to do with the Facebook thing and how they abandoned quotation marks HTML5 and now it's way faster and stuff. Like okay. iOS, yeah.
So here's my take on the whole native... I don't want to say native versus web because I think that's silly. Native and web technologies. Native will always be ahead of web, always, because native gets to iterate faster and they get to go closer to the metal, right? It's the operating system level. So they're always going to have some better technologies, some faster technologies, and the web will always be playing catch up. But that's kind of okay. I'm all right with that because the web gets to see the future, effectively, by looking at what native is doing currently, decide what works, decide what mistakes need to be avoided, and then standardize on that stuff. So that when the web does start implementing this stuff, they can do it right. And they do it interoperably so that it works on all platforms that, you know, can render a web page rather than just being tied down to one platform. And so, yeah, it is kind of a hare and a tortoise situation with native technologies and web. So, I mean, if in the short term, if you're thinking, you know, what's the subjective best technology to use to build an app today, it's probably going to be native in terms of things like speed and in terms of access to APIs, right? Because in native, you're going to get access to a whole bunch more sensors than you can get through the web, right? Things like the camera, the address book, all of these kind of things. All of that stuff is coming on the web. It's either, you know, slowly arriving now or it's going to be arriving soon, but it might not be ready just yet. But in the long term, yeah, I would bet on the web because native is always going to be tied to a specific native platform. And So the problem with having, let's say, a native iOS app is that it works great on iOS and it doesn't work at all on Android or BlackBerry or any other platform. It's a binary situation. You either get your app working beautifully or you get zero. You get nothing. Whereas on the web, we have this option to use progressive enhancement where you can say everybody's going to get a base experience of either reading content or shopping or doing something, accomplishing a task. And then for the browsers that have access to cool features, you know, the camera, the address book, whatever, APIs, you can add that stuff in on top. But you can reach far, far, far more people. So it all depends on your priorities, whether you're thinking about the short term or the long term. And in the short term, yeah, maybe native's the way to go. But then also you have to think about reach. And native can never, unless you got the budget to build a native iOS, a native Android, native BlackBerry, native this, native that, unless you got the budget to do devices or apps for all those kinds of devices, you're not going to have the same reach as the web. Now, that said, there are people that are using the web but to build things that might as well be native apps. And by that, I mean they're building stuff on the web, but they're using a very specific set of technologies, and you have to have those technologies in order to use their app. So it might as well be native. I mean, if you've got something that's on the web, but it requires JavaScript and geolocation and this API and that API, and if you don't have those, if your browser is missing just one of those things, then you get zero, you get zip, then you shouldn't really be on the web. That's kind of not the way the web works. And you'd be much better off spending your time building a native app, which is perfect for that kind of stuff, where you can say, mm-hmm. I know exactly what's installed. I know exactly what APIs I have access to. So as in so many things, it depends.
Yeah, indeed. The hashtag, it depends.
It depends. I mean, that could be my answer to all these questions. Really. It depends. Yeah.
I don't know. My good friend Zuck recently said HTML5 was the biggest mistake he'd ever made.
Yeah, so it's funny because, you know, back when Facebook were saying, yeah, we're betting on HTML5, it's great. HTML5, and when I say HTML5 here, I don't really mean HTML5, the spec, obviously. I'm using it as the buzzword marketing term to mean web technologies, right? Because that's what it really means, web technologies, advanced web technologies. People that were promoting advanced web technologies say, see, Facebook are using it, that's why you should use it. And now that Facebook have changed their mind, those same people are going, yeah, but you can't just listen to Facebook. That's just one company, right? But we have to make a difference between the technologies, the web technologies, call them HTML5 if you will, and the implementation, because the Facebook app, even though it was using web technologies, was not very webby or not very web friendly in my opinion, because the performance on that thing sucked. Mm. Not initially, but over time it got very crusty and there's a lot of performance issues with it. So I don't know if it is fair to blame the technology there. It's just it was kind of a shitty app anyway. And, you know, to say, yeah, it was because we chose HTML5, that's why it was crap. It's like, it was kind of the way you built it as well.
Right. I mean, who knows how many factors are involved here. Unfortunately, not everybody makes the choices they make based on the intelligent things they hear on the Shop Talk show. They may make them on little news articles they read.
Luckily for us, everyone on the internet has very nuanced opinions and doesn't decide to take complete black and white stance on technologies. So
nobody does that.
Nobody does that.
No, not one person I know who's ever emailed me. Oh, we can't leave it at that. We got to do a funner one. Let's see. How about we do like a CSS challenge kind of question? Does that sound fun?
Yeah, bring it on.
Yeah, I don't think. We'll see. There's smarter people than me in the room here. I want to get Joanne Masterson writes in. We have to imagine this in our minds together. I want to give one line list items, say 50 characters or less, the same amount of white space between the line as the line height for paragraph text. So like paragraph, couple of list items, another paragraph, all that stuff has the same amount of white space in between it. But I want to give multi-line list items, ones that flow across multiple lines, like sentences in a paragraph, more white space between them. Is there a pure CSS solution for that? So if it's like paragraph, list item, paragraph, all those have the same amount of space between it, but those multi-line list items should have a little bit more on the top and bottom of them. Is there a pure CSS solution? I want to set this up for a client so that he doesn't have to put a special class name on the one-line list items. I'd like for CSS to select for that, if possible. Can we imagine that in our mind?
I'm having trouble picturing it.
Yeah, I should have probably drawn it out. I've read the question enough that it kind of makes sense to me, but I think that the crux is the 50 character. Like, so if a list item doesn't break, it's not long enough to break because it's
like
of the
foo, bar, pizza.
And then like lorem ipsum, blah, 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 like, and then that one is such a long sentence that it happens to hit the edge of the container that it's in wrap. Can you select those somehow differently? Because you know how long a list item is? I'm think that you can't in CSS. Like, you can't just say, yeah.
But maybe you don't need to. Maybe, okay, so you've got line height in all list items. That's the vertical space you want. And then if the list items had a negative top margin that was the same amount? No, I don't know what I'm saying.
I can see. No, I mean,
I'm going to say, welcome to the wonderful world of JavaScript.
I mean, that would be the easy thing. You just measure the length, and you give them a class based on JavaScript. It'd pretty much be a one-liner. I mean, it would be you'd have to run a little loop, but still.
So it's kind of like the opposite of first line, right? Because we get access to first line with CSS. But
I wonder if first line could help us.
Long lines as a pseudo selector or something. I don't know. I think you'd have to use JavaScript, Joanne.
I understand the class. You don't want to add class names on them because that's just too much work. I guess the other thing is just measuring number of characters, especially in a fluid width design, doesn't guarantee you that it's going to break. I wonder if there's a JavaScript way that you can guarantee that the line has broken. I guess you could just measure the height, and if it's taller, the height.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll write up a little code pen for you, Joanne, and do the JavaScript way. But you'd have to be we're kind of thinking that the CSS can't do what you need it to do in its JavaScript.
And Dave, tell me this. When you do the JavaScript way, will you do that as a jQuery plugin?
Oh, of course. That's all I do, Jeremy. I just make tiny jQueries.
You and your jQuery.
I love it. Well, I mean, I didn't write a book on DOM scripting or anything, so O'Reilly just contacted me for the tiny jQuery book. That's not true. I'm lying, but it would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing is that pretty much everything you've ever written, somebody else has forked it on GitHub and created, you know, a non-jQuery version of it anyway, so you don't have to.
Right.
Yeah, no, and the most impressive thing is when people just like write it in like 140 characters, and I'm just kind of sitting there like, I'm not that good at JavaScript, but I have a beautiful API. So yeah, it's fun. Well, you took fit text, right? And you did that.
Oh, I didn't do that. Well, here's what I did. I went onto Twitter and said, hey, has anyone created a non jQuery version of fit text? And sure enough, some guy in Poland, and it was on GitHub, and it works really well. So the lazy web was my friend.
Awesome. Interesting. I didn't know that. Is that linked up in the repository? That might come in useful to me occasionally.
I don't know if it's a direct fork or what, but I could find it. I could look for it.
Okay, well, whatever, yeah, just because we mentioned it, that's like show notes material. A few people in the chat room are like, you have show notes? Like, like they should go out in the iTunes if you subscribe through there. And otherwise, if you just, you know, go to shoptalkshow.com and click like the name of the person in the article. I mean, they're not all right on the homepage. You have to click on the person and then you go to the, you know, the single page for that show. And I link up relevant stuff and say what the questions were and stuff.
Why don't you read my blog, guys?
Anyway, let's do the thing where we say goodbye.
I know, this is such a sad one. Jeremy, thank you so much for calling in all the way from from Brighton, and we really appreciate it. And how can people get in touch with you, buy your books, give you money? How does that work?
Let's see. Well, they can read my website, adactio.com.
Oh, I'm glad you said it out loud. I had it wrong in my head for so long. Adactio.
That's right. Adactio, just like it's spelled.
I know, but I had it wrong in my head for a long time, and then I never could boot it, but then I knew it didn't match up with what the... Okay, adactio.com.
A-D-A-C-T-I-O, adactio. Yeah, good. That's I do write about web stuff there, but be warned, I also write about, you know, I don't know, space and other things. So it's just my head on a website, basically, the inside of my head, and it's not a pretty sight. I'm on Twitter as Adactio, but again, there'll be a lot of toast-related tweets on there, a lot of pictures of what I'm having for lunch. So I don't think people probably should be following me. They're only going to be disappointed.
I think 150,000 people disagree.
They're spam bots. That's 150,000 spam bots.
SEO plus plus.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thanks again so much for coming on. Everyone who came out in the chat room, thanks a lot. I know we had a couple live audio issues, but thanks you guys for putting up with all that. And then, we always appreciate that. If the audio was so terrible, you left and go subscribe in iTunes. And that'll be for you in an MP3 that you can save on your hard drive. And follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Chris, you got anything else to add?
ShopTalkShow.com.